for coming to my podcast.
Ah, you're welcome. This is my first podcast ever. So I have no idea how things work around here. We'll just talk about it.
Yes. Do you listen much to podcasts, or you're not a listener either?
I am a big listener of podcasts, but the RPG podcasts have actually been dropping in popularity. My favorite ones are mostly the two or three history and philosophy based ones from BBC Radio 4, for example. And in terms of RPG, let me see which ones I remember. I listened to Fear the Boot. I listened to Cannon Puncture. I listened to without my list in front of me, it's hard to remember. I used to listen to some old school podcasts, but I dropped all of them. I guess these are the ones that I look forward to. I used to listen to a lot of Happy Jack RPG, which was more about more the kind of readers write in and the crew gives some advice with a lot of swearing and talking about beer. What about you? A lot of other podcasts?
Yes, I used to listen to Fear the Boot.
Mm-hmm.
I joined them until episode 100 or 120 or something like that. And okay. Then I felt they started repeating themselves, so I stopped listening.
I see, yeah.
These days I listen to the Podcast, Walking Eye. And there's this German podcast by P. Halbe that
P. Halbe.
I follow that one as well.
Three of them, but dropped them, but I can't really remember why I did. I guess it just didn't keep me for too long. Podcast was a long time ago.
Yeah. P. Halbe did this episode on what are indie RPGs, and it was really, really good. I wish more people in Sweden spoke German. So I could share it.
So I think as for P. Halbe, I just listened to a few episodes that I picked from the archive, and others just seemed like basic intro segments of what are RPGs. So I don't really remember exactly, but that is basically the memories I have.
Right. Should we do like some introduction and I can cut and paste it to the start of the episode then later?
Sure.
Good evening. My name is Wilhelm and this is the 14th episode, and it is the 6th episode if you are following the podcast in English. And with me today I have Alex from Switzerland.
Hello everybody. I live in Switzerland, but I'm not actually Swiss. I'm half Austrian, half French. I lived in Switzerland, of course, but I also lived many years in Portugal, 1 year in Namibia, 2 years in Thailand. So I feel more like a world citizen than anything else. I'm here on this podcast because I answered Wilhelm's call on his blog, I guess. I don't know how I stumbled upon the blog. I think it was because of Google Plus. I'm not quite sure. Today I discovered that you had actually already commented on my blog about half a year ago. So I guess we know each other from a bit more.
Yes, it's a small internet. You were writing about your experiences with the solar system.
That's right.
And the internet is such a small place. I found it somehow, and I said, someone directed me to this blog post. My opinions are these. And then an hour later, Eero, who wrote Solar System, drops in, and, I sent you, see that you're speaking about my game. I think you should do the following.
That's right. Then Harald dropped in, and he did the German translation of Solar System, so we were all complete, I guess.
But yes, I have posted a call for interview victims on my blog. I would like to speak with people from different parts of the world and hear what gaming is like in their parts. And since you're this world citizen, maybe you can take care of the whole world. We'll see about that. But how long have you been living in Switzerland?
I was born in Iceland and moved to Switzerland when I was 2 weeks old. And my father then had a job as an engineer in a company that rented engineers to foreign electricity companies. So there was always multi-year contracts, and he just took the entire family with him. So I lived in Switzerland, then in Portugal, then back to Switzerland, then to Namibia, then to... Actually, I got that wrong. First to Namibia, then to Switzerland, then to Portugal, then back to Switzerland, then to Thailand, back to Switzerland. And then I was old enough to stay on my own, and my father kept moving on. I feel very Swiss, and I applied for citizenship now. I speak the local dialect. I'm married to a Swiss woman. So I think over the years, it's soaked in.
And you're living in the German-speaking part of Switzerland?
Yes, indeed. I'm German is also my first language. I live in Zurich.
So I'm very curious about the gaming scene in Switzerland. And in your case, it would be Zurich, I presume, since you live there.
Absolutely. The gaming scene itself is small, and I feel it's very small. And the strange thing is that if you're here in Zurich and you put out a call to find new players, like I did when I restarted my gaming in the autumn of 2006, there were a lot of foreigners that answered my call. My suspicion is that these people come here and they have no friends. They start to work at some international company, or they study. And then they realize, oh, maybe I should go look for a hobby or something. And they find my presence on the net. And so many of my players are actually Germans. I, at the very beginning, had an American, a half New Zealander, and some English-speaking people. It felt very international. And only recently, one of my English groups actually switched back to German because the last English speaker was unable to join anymore. So sometimes people wonder where the Swiss players are, and actually I don't know. It seems to me that either they have found their gaming group when they were in school, and therefore they don't have the need to reach out over the internet and find other people. That's how I never get to see them. There is a local con once a year here in the Zurich area, and there I see maybe 50 people all in all. And the people I meet there are absolutely different from the ones that answer my call on Facebook or that I meet through other means. It's very, very strange. I think that the reason is if you're Swiss and you have your old gaming group, and you stay in your local area. Switzerland is very small. You don't move hundreds of miles and live in a different city just to go to university. So you can stay close to home. And then your old gaming groups don't break apart. And if you start new, like I did, then you meet many of the foreigners that live here. And we do have a lot of foreigners in my quarter of the city. There's about 40% foreigners, and I think the Swiss average is about 20%. So chances are very high.
I was thinking about games. I suppose you don't see what the generic Swiss player plays then, since there's so little communication between different spheres of gamers. But what do you play at these small cons you have in Zurich?
From memory, what I remember was a very wide variety. The standard game that most people know would be Das Schwarze Auge, the Dark Eye, the German mainstream RPG, I would say, and D&D, of course. But on the list of games that you can sign up to, there were Homebrews, there was Call of Cthulhu, there was a game that was called Kobolds, I think. I don't remember much, except that it was a huge crowd and they kept hailing their king or something and trying to find human babies to eat. Then I played Legend of the Five Rings. There was a vampire group. It was very diverse. And I myself ran some Labyrinth Lord. So in terms of games played, it felt very much not like the mainstream that I was expecting. When I try to find players for new groups on Facebook, for example, I created a RPG in Zurich Facebook group and or a Facebook page. And this is where you will find that many of the people interested in playing would like to play just the Schwarze Auge or D&D 4E. So on Facebook, you will find that they are very much in the mainstream. A different subset of players that goes to the con, I guess.
Maybe. I find that people are more willing to try new games when they go to conventions. They may play one or two games at home and then they go to a con to see new things.
That could be, of course. Certainly what I try to do when I go to a con and try to discover new things.
Do you know if there are any games that are developed in Switzerland? The Schwarze Auge is from Germany, I suppose.
I've heard people say that they and a friend are working on a setting or working on a game on some homebrew system, but I don't think there's anything published. Maybe there was one that I faintly remember, but it never caught on. I think you would have to consider how big Switzerland actually is. We have 7 million people here, and maybe at most the half of them are German speakers. So we have 3.5 million. And over to the north in Germany, there is 80 or more million people. So that the chances are very high that anything that has been written and published is actually from Germany. And I think all the different corners of Switzerland, the French speaking, they orient themselves towards the French part and play French games. And I wouldn't know what gaming is like in Lausanne or other French-speaking parts of Switzerland, cities in Switzerland, or Italian for that. It's very segregated, I would say. And as for the German parts of Switzerland, I don't know anything. I am no publisher. I'm not even sure. We have book publishing, of course, but I'm not even sure there's a Swiss game publisher at all.
Of course, you can lean on the German gaming scene, which is huge.
Absolutely. And they have strong publishing, they have companies that produce translations. And we are now in the very curious situation that there is no German translation of D&D 4E. And that is very surprising because almost all the other big things get translated.
You mentioned Labyrinth Lord and listening to old school podcasts.
Yes.
Is the old school something that interests you?
Absolutely. Yes, I'm a big fan of old school. When I started playing in autumn of 2006, I had not played for 10 years or more. So I ended my gaming with AD&D Second Edition, went away, and then when I came back because through blogs I had discovered a guy called Grey Wolf with a blog, and he had a review there of a PDF edition of this rules cyclopedia. And then I remembered gaming, and I bought that PDF, and from there it all came back. Grey Wolf had then developed M20, which I really liked. It was simple, fit on maybe 5 pages all in all. And I got my friends from the old days and tried to find some new friends on the internet, and we started gaming again. And then we quickly moved on to D&D 3.5 at the time, and that is what we played for many years. And as we kept playing, and when the first campaign reached level 15 and 16, and we played another campaign, and then later we moved on to Pathfinder, and we discovered Adventure Paths, and we played those two up to those higher levels, I realized how extremely cumbersome it was and how it didn't feel like what I wanted and what I remembered from back in the days. And then suddenly old school hit the blogosphere, and I discovered that other people were also not satisfied. And the first one that I stumbled across was Labyrinth Lord, and I picked it up. I have tried convincing my old group, but that didn't really work that well. So I just started new groups, and I've been playing in multiple groups for a while now. Some of them play the old games, some of them play the newer ones, and I'm really flexible, so I get to game a lot.
Oh, it's good to be an omnivore when it comes to gaming.
Absolutely, and every second Monday is Indie Game Night, and this is where we play all the one-shots that we can get our hands on.
the Nordnordost blog and podcast has a focus on indie gaming.
So I realized, yes.
Yes. So we would be very curious to hear your, well, what indie games you've been playing lately and if you have any favorites.
Oh my God, I don't have my notes here. I can't read my blog. So let me think. Just recently we had gained some new interested people and for this indie game night, and we decided that we wanted to do a best of and just show off the things that we really enjoyed as a group. And the number one thing there was In a Wicked Age. That one we really liked. We also had Dogs in the Vineyard. That one we didn't play as much, but we also enjoyed. We had Western City. Western City, I think, I'm not sure whether you're familiar with it. The author is a German guy called Dünne. And there's also an English translation, but I'm not sure whether it made it to Sweden.
No, it hasn't made any splash here. Okay. I asked some German gamers for suggestions for German indies that I should check out, and Western City was one of the games they mentioned. I haven't gotten around to reading it yet or getting it yet, but I had heard of it at least.
So I recommend it.
It's good.
Yes, absolutely. It's a GM-less game. So, well, maybe I'll continue my list and then we can return to Western City later. Another game that we played for a few sessions and that I sort of liked, I'm not quite so sure, was Apocalypse Now. As you might know by now, there is a lot of Vincent Baker games. One of the guys in this indie group is a big Vincent Baker fan, so he brings all of them. We also played Solar System, of course, which you already mentioned seeing on my blog. And we gave some other games a try. I'm not sure whether you want to count Fate games as indie anymore, but we played several Fate variants. And in the end, I wrote a customized Fate in 10 or 20 pages for this indie game night that we also used. Let me think what else. A lot of games were very polarizing. People thought, it's very interesting. Maybe we just played it wrong. And that is a bit unfortunate because this is a sort of democratic process. So whenever we wonder, what should we play next? Then I might say, I'm interested in getting Polaris right, and people just wiggle their heads and it doesn't gather enough votes to actually make it. Another of these games that was a bit, I don't know whether we should try it again. Fiasco, for example. We sort of liked it and we loved it, but at the end, I thought, man, this is depressing. And then the next time somebody suggests Fiasco, then again, the wiggling of heads starts and then it doesn't get voted in. But this is basically the list that I remember. I am sure we played lots more because in my mind, I see the blog page in front of me where I had listed maybe 20 or so. Maybe during our talk, we'll find some more.
Yes. So tell me more about Western City.
That's right, Western City. Western City is GM-less, and at the beginning, people brainstorm situations and locations that they would like to see. So This basically works because Westerns is a genre where all the tropes are really well known. So people might say, we want a train, we want a train robbery, we want dynamite, we want an undertaker, we want American natives, we want booze, things like that. We want a shootout in a saloon. And then we start picking that, the things that we want to put there. We start brainstorming people that are in the city. And afterwards, we distribute those. So in a way, it's a bit similar to the setup of In a Wicked Age. Then the resolution is much simpler than In a Wicked Age. It's just D6 based. But the interesting thing is that I might start a scene and say, well, my character, this Undertaker, is here in the scene, and he's about to go into that saloon because he wants to have his money back or something. And then other people can buy NPCs from the pool that we established and say, I will play Dirty Harry, the crazy shooter. Even though it's not his character, he's on the NPC pile. You can just pay for him and introduce them. And this is how we get antagonism in the game. And I think that works really well. It's not directly player character versus player character, but of course, this being a GM-less game, there is some player versus player elements in there.
I think I get a feeling for how it plays. I recognize lots of elements in your description from other games, and it sounds really interesting. I'd better really get this game, because I've had problems playing the Western genre in general. We have a Swedish game called just Western, and it's really fancy, and it's been around forever, and the third or fourth edition is about to be released now. But every time I sit down to think of a Western adventure or Western story, all I think of is the good, the bad, and the ugly one. and then nothing else happens. Nothing more happens. It just gets stuck there.
Yeah, this brainstorming of locations and people at the very beginning, I think that's important because it generates ideas that will then keep your game alive. Whereas if you start with just one situation, based on many of the Western movies are essentially based on one cool idea. The one person who comes into this town and the two rich families are fighting against each other, and he hires out to either side. And if you just have that, I'm not sure whether that's good enough to actually run an entire session many hours. So you need more, and this brainstorming at the beginning would help you introduce the garden, a lover, a waterfall, and more than just merchants that are fighting each other, but maybe a coal mine and just more stuff. And if you have more stuff, then it's more alive, more surprising maybe.
Do you see any crossover or inspiration between your indie gaming and your old school gaming?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So I guess I could start with the negatives. What I didn't like in my D&D 3.5 and in my Pathfinder games was this character building, this front loading of the game by thinking about my character and my plans as a player and as a GM, the difficulty of designing encounters that seemed fair, that challenged my power gamer without depressing my casual gamers. And it was a lot of effort. The prep for players and for GMs was hard. And the indie games, they basically encouraged me to do away with it, because most of them start very quickly. There is, if you want to count Burning Wheel maybe as an indie game, then of course that's maybe not true, because character generation takes a long time. Or maybe if you think Traveller is an old school game, then character generation also takes a long time. So it's not a general rule that is true for all of them. But for myself, that was very important. It was very important to play Spirit of the Century and just talk a bit, write down some numbers, start playing, and then fill out the remaining aspects as we go. And as a game master, not knowing exactly what the characters are going to be, and not the players having so many ways of influencing the game, that showed me that improvisation as a GM is fun. I enjoy doing it. I can't prepare for it, and that's better. And then in my old school gaming, there's maybe this idea that you prepare dungeons or other adventures, but it doesn't compare in any way with the work that needs to be done for adventure path play or encounter design play. You just roll some dice, and then there's orcs or a dragon, and either you run or you don't, and then here old school gaming has a bit more tools. You have random reaction tables, and then some of these monsters are friendly, and you can influence them, and the expectations are that since you can't fight, then you should talk or trick them out of their treasure, and all of that results in a very different gameplay. And I think I discovered old school gaming and indie gaming at the same time, and they definitely influenced my views of how games should run, how much prep I want to make, what level of improvisation I need, and what sort of note-taking I actually need, especially if we talked about Western City or in the Wicked Age. You draw some cards. This is the inspiration at the very beginning. You write down some notes, and you have a little relationship diagram of who hates whom and who loves whom, and off you go. And this is absolutely something that you can use for every game, I think. Makes every game better.
I'm running a Swords and Wizardry game now. It's also one of those old school clones. And I recognize what you're saying, that the attraction of playing. Well, we could say that the retro clones are traditional games. They have rules for combat and not much more. But playing it in this freeform way that we learned from indie games, where we just quickly generate some characters and start the adventure, and then we'll fill in the details as we go. And it's very liberating to just be able to play and don't have to prepare anything. Or
yes, I agree. There's also things that are different. We talked about this, the difference between a solar system and D&D, for example. And in my case, the situation was very, the comparison was unavoidable because I converted a D&D 3.5 game into a solar system game. And then we made new characters in the same setting, and off we went. And we played for 9 sessions, I think, until the first character transcended. And now I've had some time to pause and look back, and I see that the indie way of, for example, rolling first and interpreting dice afterwards, that is not something that I really want to introduce into my old school games, because this abstract conflict resolution produces a different feel at the table than the actual rolling of to hit and damage and whether you, many of the small things that you actually do at the table when you're playing an old school game where the rules don't cover everything, but the expectation is that you use common sense to resolve it as if it were a rule. I use fireball as an example. The rules would, for example, say that there's this little ball of fire that travels along a line until it hits something, and then it explodes and it does blah and blah damage. But this little element of the ball traveling can then be exploited by other people. What happens if you throw sand up in front of you? What happens if there is a wall? What happens if you're around the corner? You can use physics and you can imagine the situation and try to apply common sense to the situation. Whereas in a solar system or some other abstract game. Maybe if you're using the short resolution system of Burning Wheel, you would roll first, you would get a success, and then you would narrate why it worked. Well, obviously, if you did a lot of damage, therefore you did not manage to hide behind a corner, the fireball hit you in the face. And this this is something that I don't want to carry over into my old school games. This is something I did, this abstract resolution, I don't like it. And similarly, the social rules of Burning Wheel, for example, where talking and haggling and all that is just as complex, mechanically complex as fighting, is something that I don't like in my old school games. Because there, I totally like the non-existence of rules. And even though in the past I wanted to have rules to cover social conflict, now that I've seen it at work in Burning Wheel, I realized I was wrong. I don't want that. I want there to be no rules and to look my players in the eyes and just act it out. Or I want to pose little social riddles. The guard looks at you, but you see that his fingers are shaking. Maybe he's a drug addict. Do you have some drugs on you? Do you want to bribe him with drugs or money? And then you can just do that, and there is no rules, no dice. And then in my old school game, that results in a tempo change, in a style change, and I really like this variation. Sometimes you roll dice and you roll damage and it's fighting, and then at other times you look your GM in the eye and you just talk. And in the solar system, everything at the end seemed very similar. Whatever you did, you announced something, you talked about consequences, you picked up your dice and you rolled them, you looked at them, you interpret the result, and next scene. And this uniformity of resolution mechanics, so I no longer appreciate that as much. So whereas before we talked about things that in games and old school have in common, there are also things that they don't have in common and which I don't want to carry over.
All right, I'm back.
Yes, I'm back as well. Excellent.
I have a cold that's just in the back of my throat waiting to break out. So I have one cup of tea and one glass of water, and I'm alternating between them. And I'm hoping it either disappears or breaks out now this weekend, because next weekend I'm having a house con, and I'm going to be, well, running games for 5 days straight.
Wow, that's a lot. Over Christmas, I invited my extended circle of gamers and former players in my groups, maybe 20 people in all, and just said, if you don't have any plans over Christmas and you would like to do some gaming, my wife and I will be here on December 25th and we'll just be gaming starting at 1 until we fall over. And in the end, I think we had 6 or 7 people come and we played 3 different games, I think. And at the end, we were just gone. And then to repeat that for another 4 days, I'm not sure I can do it. Yeah, so that was also interesting. I decided I wanted to play something that I liked. So I put Labyrinth Lord on the list. And I wanted to play something that I had enjoyed from my indie game night. So I added Mountain Witch. And then another friend of mine said that since my wife was there, and we don't usually have many women who game, then he would like to try Kagematsu. And I already knew what Kagematsu implied, but didn't tell my wife. So then when everybody arrived, he said, well, you're going to play a samurai? And she said, oh, that's cool. But she didn't realize that she was going to be talking for half the time and feel like a GM. That's how we started our Christmas con.
I haven't played Kagematsu yet. It's on the to-do list, but we are waiting for the right group of players to congregate so we can play it.
be interesting to see how you react to that. Because at the beginning, I was interested and I liked it. But in the end, everybody felt very constrained by the moves available to the characters. But if you haven't played it, then maybe you wouldn't see it at first. But when you play it, it starts with a lot of freedom. But in the end, I don't know. Not many people were not that happy at the end. If you remember Kagematsu, do you remember the player sheet that you have, or have you not seen it and you're just interested in the abstract?
I have read some reviews of it and heard people talk about it, but I haven't played it myself. And I haven't seen the actual book myself either.
The thing is that you have a list of moves available. So all the women in the game have a list of moves. And you roll some dice and you have some points. And the better you are, the higher the moves, the higher the cost of the move that you can make. So at the beginning, you only have a handful of them to choose from. But once you've played them, you can't choose them again. So then you need higher results in order to play the remaining moves. And just as the women in this village are ever more desperate to get Kagematsu to save them, you as the player also feel ever more desperate because A, you don't have the points to actually buy the good moves, and B, the moves that you have remaining to you are all of the desperate and debasing moves. And that really feels weird at the end.
You are running out of options.
Yes, and then since my wife had no idea at all of what was happening, and she played the samurai, and she didn't know the player sheet. So for her, it was all spontaneous. She didn't realize that we were throwing us at her feet and ripping off our clothes and trying to get to sleep with him and kiss him and everything in our desperation, but also because those were the moves that were on our player sheet. And she just shook her head and said, "Man, you are all so strange. This is so weird." And this is where you felt the artificial constraints of the game and its moves.
But isn't that sort of the point of the game, to make this very artificial situation and see where it takes you?
Well, it's a game design thing of how far you want to constrain it. Because if it's too constrained, then it starts to feel scripted. And I think those of us who had a bit misgivings in that direction, they felt that it ended up being too scripted, because even though you have a lot of choice at the beginning, your choices dwindle down, and at the end, you're basically on a railroad to damnation. So maybe that is part of the design goal, to this desperation. But as a play experience, I'm not so sure.
Takes a certain kind of player, perhaps, to enjoy it. There's this Danish game called Monsegur 1244. Have you played it?
I've only heard about it. That's the one where at the very end you get to decide whether you want to burn at the stake or convert.
Yes, that's the one.
That also sounded very depressing.
It is very, very depressing, but also very interesting to play, because you start out with these characters who are they are besieged by the Crusaders then. And you say, of course, I will denounce my fate and, well, live happily ever after. And then you play them for 3 or 4 hours and you decide, no, this character wants to burn. And it surprises you. Well, but why? And you understand, no, burning is the right choice for this character. It's a very strange experience.
So some of the games that we've played have this... I guess Luke Crane would say game design is mind control. So some of these games encourage certain behavior that is surprising. For example, we played Pirates once, also Vincent Baker, I think. And some of us enjoy the PvP aspects of the game. And you look at the moves that are available to you. You are on this ship. The captain is dead. Who is going to be the next captain? Things are very civilized. But within 20 minutes or 30 minutes, we were raping the villagers and burning things down and behaving like the worst pirates, being ashamed at the table and laughing in desperation at the stupidity of our moves. But we wanted those bonuses, and we really wanted to be prepared for the next move, also because we suspected the other players at the table to be planning against us. And so we said, we need to be prepared. I need to do something cruel. And then you would do something cruel and crazy and pirate-like. And even though you wanted to play a romantic pirate, and maybe you were thinking of Pirates of the Caribbean, at the end, the game made you behave in terrible ways. The good thing about this game was that I didn't feel as constrained as in the Kagematsu game. Maybe this constraintness is a sort of slider, and everyone has a certain preference. And for me, Kagematsu was too constrained. Pirates was terrible because I don't enjoy playing evil characters, but it was perfect in the from a game design point of view, because we were playing evil characters even though most of us didn't want to. And unfortunately, I didn't play this Danish game yet. And I'd be interested to see how he manages to plant this this decision that at the beginning nobody wants to burn, and then this plant grows, and in the end some of you will put their character to the fire.
I think it's connected to the strong faith aspect of the game. When you start playing, you don't know much about the Cathar faith, and you don't identify with your character, so you see the whole event from our modern eyes, from our perspective. And then through the game you are introduced to the Cathar faith and their reality. And as you role play, you start becoming your character and accept their faith. And then your perspective changes, and it becomes a natural choice to burn. And it's a very strange experience. And I can't recommend this game enough. It's brilliant.
Okay, I'll put it on our list. I'll put it on the list. I wonder, does it have replay value?
Yes, to some extent. I've played it 5 or 6 times.
Okay, that's a lot.
And if someone came to me and said, oh, couldn't you please run this Monsegur game for us? We'd like to see it. I would do so, but I wouldn't suggest it myself anymore. I think it has worn out now after, these 5 or 6 times.
Yeah, this is also a bit of an issue that I have with the indie games, is that many of them feel like one-trick ponies. They are very good at a particular situation, but if you don't want to play this situation anymore, then you're stuck. You need to switch games. I really like Mountain Witch, for example, but how often can you go and fight the Mountain Witch? Then there's limited replay value, I think.
Yes. Almost all my favorites of the indie games have very limited replay value, but they are awesome for those times while it still lasts, because they're so focused to solving this kind of problem or producing this kind of game experience that they are the best option for doing exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the perspective of somebody who wants to find new players and find a new group, it's a bit hard to sell people on something like that. I guess the thing is that if we're playing board game night, it's obvious that we'll be switching games all the time, and every game is designed for a very specific situation, and that's what we're going to play. But if people come from a traditional RPG background, then the indie game philosophy of this specific situational design and the one-shot aspect, or maybe you have a six-shot, but it's not going to
still
be
the same.
A year campaign. That really narrows it down. So even though I play a total of maybe 9 or 10 nights a month, only two of those are indie games because there's just not enough people interested in that.
Yes, I recognize the problem. People who have played many traditional games and like playing traditional games, they want to devote themselves to this game. They want to level their character, learn the rules by their own books, study to know the system, to master the system. Whereas the indie games, well, almost all of them, well, you play one evening and you're good. You can put that book down and never open it again, and you have experienced the game. But yeah, to really experience, like Dungeons and Dragons, well, you better 10 or 20 sessions, then you're just scraping at the surface of what this game has to offer.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but as you said, it's good to be an omnivore in gaming. So if you're lucky enough to have it all, then that's excellent.
I've sort of gotten what I wanted from the interview at this point. Would you like to talk about something that you are very interested in and want to make a discussion of?
I think we touched upon all the things that have been that I've had on my mind recently in terms of old school gaming, indie games, all of that. So I would basically be now interested in hearing about your point of view, but maybe I should just listen to some older podcasts.
No, absolutely. I would be happy to talk about my views on, well, everything, because it's always in context of my discussion with whoever I'm talking with. I did the last English episode, I interviewed Vivian from the United States. Mm-hmm. And we had this long conversation about conventions, comparing Swedish conventions with American conventions.
Okay.
Because that was what we had talked about. So if there's something you want to know about me or Swedish gaming, I would love to talk about it.
So one thing that's on my mind is how to find new players and create new groups and foster an environment where a big pool of people, maybe in your town, 30 people or so, that know each other and spontaneously form groups, play for a while, and then dissolve and recombine into different sets. That is something that I would like, and I'm sort of, I have maybe 10 people that are really interested in gaming, then I have 5 people that don't like to play with strangers from the internet, I have some people that can only play during the week once per month, and others that can play only on one Sunday per month. And then how can I find more? There's a German website called Spielerzentrale where you can try and find new players. But if you send them emails, then you'll realize that most of them haven't updated their profile in 5 years or more. There's nearby gamers, but there's only 2 or 3 people in Zurich that have put their mark there. So my personal trick in the recent year has been Facebook. And I wonder, what do you do? How do you find people? Or how do Swedish people find other players? Is that from school? Is that later? How does it work?
We have a very good internet forum called rollspel.nu, that's roleplaying.nu then. And there are loads of gamers there. So if I move anywhere in Sweden, I'll just post there and I will reconnect with whatever gamers who are on the forum who live in that area.
So that appears to be very good coverage.
Yes, it is very good coverage. Also, the Swedish government actually pays us to roleplay, a situation that I think is somewhat unique.
I think I've heard about this. So it's actually true then?
Yes,
you,
it is.
You basically register as a gaming club or something like that?
Yes, and well, it's much more profitable if you are still teenagers. Well, not profitable, but it's easier to get money if you are teenagers, because it running a game club will teach you democracy and how to share and how to organize and such things. So the government think it's worthwhile to fund such activities.
It sounds awesome from here. I'm not sure whether you see all the possible abuses or something, but in theory it sounds awesome.
Yes, it is awesome. And that means that there are loads of gaming clubs in Sweden, especially if you are a younger player, if you're still in your teens. If once you get a little bit older, I'm 35 now.
Mm-hmm.
So for my age group, I find that's not really an option. On the other hand, rather than finding gamers, I have found that it's easier to create gamers. Find people that you like hanging out with and teach them to game instead of finding gamers that you like to hang out with.
Interesting model. Yes, maybe I should think about that. What I did is I put up a poster at work in my office, just hung it on the wall, some image of orcas and a sheet of paper explaining what role-playing games are. And it's not really very close to my desk, so people can just walk by and read it at their own time. But still, that hasn't attracted a single player yet. So maybe I don't know. I need to find some ritual that allows me to start talking about gaming and then giving them an invitation.
Yes. Why don't you come by and try sometime? We'll play something easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should do that.
Have you played Zombie Cinema?
No, never.
It is a brilliant game to introduce people to gaming, because it has so very simple rules and, well, almost everyone knows zombie movies.
That's true, yes.
So I've had great success using that particular game to introduce people to gaming. So I can really recommend it. And it's a good fun game. We have played it for years and we still play it every once in a while, just us veteran gamers.
Oh, good. That also goes on my list then.
It has very good replay value.
Okay. Yeah, I should try that then.
Well, that was all for this time. I would like to thank you, Alex, for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you.
It was great having you.
Interesting. I totally appreciate this international perspective, having gamers from abroad. I need to listen to the remaining episodes.
Thank you, and good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.